Court is ready.
Excuse me. Be seated.
And the court is ready to hear argument from petitioners in Reinhart v. Young.
May it please the court, Mr. Rex Easley will present arguments for petitioners. Petitioner is reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Rex Easley from Victoria. I represented Thelma Reinhart and Sally Trimmy in this case, Richmond, Texas. I think the issue in this case is the standard for allowing an instruction on unavoidable accident, or whether we're going to allow a general submission of unavoidable accident in every negligence case, or perhaps whether this court should abolish its submission as it being subsumed under the comparative negligence submission, broad form submission. First, what does an unavoidable accident instruction do in a case for us that are trying these lawsuits? I think, from my experience, what it clearly does, it gives the jury an easy way. It comments on the weight of the evidence, and, of course, it comments on the weight of the defendant's evidence in an unfair way. I think that it nudges the jury, because you're asking the jury, was the plaintiff negligent? No. Was the defendant negligent? Or yes. Yes or no. Was the defendant negligent? Yes or no. And then the instruction that preceded that says, or you can find that there was no negligence on anyone. But that's
true. They can't do that.
I think that, yes.
So, what's the problem with telling the truth?
Well, there's no problem with telling them the truth. I think where the problem comes in, from my perspective, is that you're already asking them whether either one of the parties was negligent. But then you're instructing them that no one has to be, that the occurrence... Getting tongue twisted here. Sorry. You're telling them an occurrence may be an unavoidable accident, that is, an event not proximately caused by the negligence of any party to it. And so you're giving the jury a third alternative. The trial court is setting up an environment of permissiveness. It's setting up a non-accountability for action. It overemphasizes...
Judge Heck's question is, not all accidents are caused by negligence of parties, are they? Couldn't there be an accident that doesn't involve negligence?
Yes.
You can imagine a situation, a hypothetical situation.
As a matter of fact,
where there's no negligence.
An easy hypothetical for me was in reading Justice Heck's dissent in the Winn-Dixie case. You know, I can envision that very clearly. Go in there, somebody's in there shopping, and their child runs over like a rat, tears open one corner of the cookie bag, pulls a cookie out, puts the bag back on the shelf. 2 minutes later, shopper comes by, talking to somebody, looking at something, grabs the bag, puts it in the cart, in between there, the cookie falls on the floor. 2 minutes later, before... store has a chance to notice it, before anybody has a chance to do anything, here comes the plaintiff who steps on the cookie and slips and falls. It's hard to see negligence in that case, but under the broad form comparative negligence submission, we're asking, was the plaintiff negligent in that case? And they say no. Was Winn-Dixie negligent? No. So what does the unavoidable accident instruction add? I think it comments on the weight of the defendant's testimony. And it's especially harmful when you have disputed evidence, as in this case.
If there's no disputed evidence that it's an act of God,
then
it shouldn't be going to the jury in the first place.
What I mean by that is, I think the only dispute in this case was where the accident occurred, whether it was on... How far down the slope of that freeway overpass on the Southwest Freeway in Houston, Texas did it occur? There's no credible evidence that that overpass caused an obstruction of view. If we assume that the unavoidable accident, instruction has a place in Texas jurisprudence, it doesn't have a place in this case, and it caused, I think, a wrong verdict.
In Hill v. Swindoxie, we explained that although it was error to submit this instruction, on looking at the totality of the record, we could not say it was harmful error. Can you briefly address some of the reasons why? Why, to support the statement you just made, that it caused a wrongful verdict?
That sure is a tough question.
It is a tough question, but it's one we've been wrestling with for 50 years on all types of cases.
I tried that lawsuit, and I'm not sure I can answer it. I know that when, you know, we argued to that trial judge about the submission of unavoidable accident. See, there was another accident alert. There was another instruction lurking in this, the sudden emergency. The Volkswagen's out ahead. And since my clients were countersued in this case, we didn't object to the sudden emergency instruction.
You thought it was proper in this case?
Yes, sir.
What's the difference between it one, it and unavoidable accident?
Well, unavoidable accident, you know, that's the problem with the unavoidable accident. The answer to the question is, I think unavoidable accident is supposed to try to take care of some transient, peculiar circumstance that arises, like that case with the dust, or...
In this case, if a light pole had fallen in front of the Reinhardt car and they'd stop, suddenly would that be... would that warrant an instruction like this?
An instruction on unavoidable accident?
Yes.
I guess it would be a closer question. I think I have a prejudice against the use of unavoidable accident in any case.
Well, but obviously, there's, you know, Hill v. Swindoxie.
I think
reflects some of that on this court. But in other cases, we have looked at issues like how long the jury was out. Was it a unanimous verdict or was it less than unanimous? What were some of the other questions they answered? What was the quality of testimony on both sides? Is there that type of evidence in this record that if we agreed with you that the instruction was erroneous, we could look to it in helping us conclude whether or not this
it
probably led to the rendition of an erroneous verdict?
I think that, my answer to that question is that if you look at the charge, I think you just have to look at, I don't have a good answer to that, Justice Phillips.
Seems to me that it's probably calculated to confuse the jury more than anything else. You find negligence, you find fault, you find causal relationship, proximate cause of the injury, and then you submit broad form, unavoidable accident charge as well. And they said, hey, yeah, well, there was negligence, and it did cause the accident, did produce the injuries, but it was unavoidable.
Well,
those are basically inconsistent responses, aren't they?
The problem with this instruction is that you're asking, you see, there's no way to ever know whether it's harmful or not. I mean, you can only guess.
It's true. But in cases like Patterson Dental, we establish some criteria that will help us make that guess.
Mr. Easley, one of the difficulties, seems to me, in the unavoidable accident, is it seems to always be tied with some question of a disputed fact in the record that there may have been some other thing being involved other than the negligence of the parties involved. It seems to me that begs the question of whether it's harmful. I mean, the question either is submitted in cases where there is a dispute about that issue, which means that that instruction is supposed to mean something, or it's not submitted because unavoidable action is not an issue in the case. So the difficulty in this, obviously, is it states the truth that an action is unavoidable. But is anyone ever relieved of their duty to not be negligent just because of some unusual circumstance that they're faced with? I mean, is anybody ever, I mean, are you relieved of any liability for negligent conduct proximately causing damages just because some unusual circumstance existed?
Well, I think you have unavoidable, you have new and independent cause. That's the problem that I don't know. I don't think so. If you have bad environmental conditions, you slow down. You know, if you've got the case of the falling telephone pole, to me, Justice Heck, would be a new and independent cause. It's I guess you could put it in an unavoidable accident. It's not due to the negligence of either or any of the parties involved, and it's closer than this. But, you know, this is the very problem that you've got. You've got a close question here on who was negligent, who was not. We sued them, they sued us. And the only explanation the defendant gave in the trial is that on that Southwest Freeway, he said he lost sight of it for a minute. For a moment.
But isn't that precisely the case where the instruction points out to the jury something that they may not be aware of, which is that this accident may not be anybody's fault? It may be, but it may not be.
I wonder when we have a broad form negligence, comparative negligence submission, if that's the fairest way to do it, though. Because you are asking, is the plaintiff negligent? And let them compare. And when you say, hey, it doesn't have to be anybody's negligence, well, I mean, that's automatically unfairly favoring the defendant. And
well, there's no, in the broad form comparative negligence submission, there's no space in there for assigning a percentage of negligence to no one, that it was neither the plaintiff nor the defendant's fault. The jury is that, wouldn't you agree, the jury typically thinks they're supposed to come up with a percentage that adds up to 100 in some form of
No, fashion. I wouldn't agree with that. I've been poured out so many times on special issue number one, that there's no way. They never get to sue. They never get the proximate cause. Well, sometimes they do in my cases, but I don't think that's the point at all. What I see happening is that everybody uses the word in these cases I've read, the nudge. It's a nudge. It nudges the jury into taking the easy way out. Everybody nowadays wants to take the easy way out, especially the jury. You know, they just want the easiest way out, and they don't, if they...
You've got a suit and a countersuit, both asserting negligence. Both parties asserting negligence against the other party.
Yes.
Both parties asserting proximate cause against it. Both parties asserting injury as a result of negligence and proximate cause. The jury could possibly find that neither party was negligent, neither party was a proximate cause of the other's injury. And without the unavoidable accident instruction, what you're arguing is, as I understand it, is that when you put the unavoidable accident instruction in there, you tilt it in favor of the defendant primary suit.
Especially in this case, and that may be, I guess, my answer to Justice Phillips, is that in this case, it was harmful because of the suit and countersuit. You say no, no. Because that way they didn't have to decide. This was a very lazy jury. Wanted out. The trial went on for weeks. Should have lasted 4 days. If we don't, taking just narrow facts of this case,
not just throwing out my position that I think I'll just keep going, use my 5 minutes now, and just take my, throwing out my thought that unavoidable accident ought to not be part of Texas jurisprudence in the submission of these cases. And under the narrow facts of this case, I think there was no credible evidence to justify the submission of an unavoidable accident instruction when you consider what kind of environmental factors or what must happen to justify that instruction. There was no credible evidence of it. There was a dispute as to where the accident happened with the instruction.
You think there has to be a new and intervening cause then? You can't have an unavoidable accident without something coming from the outside, a pole falling down or something else?
What I think. But as far as an instruction, I guess that's not what I'm saying. No, there can be, they can answer no on special issue one without the unavoidable accident.
If a vehicle hydroplanes on wet pavement.
Sir?
If a vehicle hydroplanes on wet pavement, person's not driving too fast for conditions. Any movement at all can cause you to hydroplane if you've got that very slim coat of moisture mixed with oil on that pavement. You have an accident. It could be an unavoidable accident. You're not driving too fast for conditions. You step on the brake. Brake doesn't work. You turn the wheel. The car doesn't turn. You're hydroplaning. So it's a phenomenon of physics that you have absolutely no control over. That's unavoidable, isn't it?
That's the defense to the negligence charge. And proximate cause. It's all there. All they have to do is, that's what the defense argues to the jury. And that's what they say in their closing argument.
So it's not only
there.
So it's not only redundant to have the unavoidable accident charge in there, it's also confusing.
Yes, it's confusing. You know, you can talk about it being misleading and confusing. I just think it doesn't have a place. I think that...
Let me ask you one other... question about how far your idea goes on this. It frequently happens that a trial judge will instruct the veneer at the beginning of trial that the mere filing of a lawsuit does not mean that anybody's liable. If he doesn't instruct them on that, frequently he allows lawyers to say that during the veneer.
Yes, sir.
And ask the panel if anybody feels contrary to that. If the trial judge gave that instruction, either at the beginning of trial or in the jury charge, would you think that would be an improper nudging?
No, sir.
What's the difference between that and this?
The difference is that I think one of the differences is where it is in the charge. Your question is when the judge charges the jury in the beginning of the trial that just because someone files a lawsuit doesn't mean that someone... How did you say that?
That there's liability.
Right. But when you get down to the definitions and the instructions that the jury's going to read in order to decide the case, and that's where the emphasis is. And I think it really changes the burden. It puts kind of a twist, a body English on the burden of the parties. I think that under the facts in this case, if you hold for that unavoidable accident instruction is proper, every dip, tree, road, sign, pothole, overpass, bridge, incline, decline, hill, dale, parked car, building would meet the test. And it should not.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear arguments from respondents.
And the court, Mr. Jeff Hoffman will present argument for respondent.
May it please the court. It's my pleasure to represent William Carl Young, the respondent in this case. I'd like to initially address myself to a number of questions that the court has asked about the role of the unavoidable accident instruction, and to some extent how it differs from the sudden emergency issue. And Professor Hodges, in his treatise on special issue submission in Texas, has devoted an entire section on that subject. And I think it sets out very succinctly what's going on with unavoidable accident and, in fact, why it is necessary. Unavoidable accident doesn't mean it's not your negligence that caused this accident and it's not your negligence that caused this accident. Unavoidable accident submits the concept, the theory, if you will, that it was, in fact, no one's negligence that caused the accident. What Professor Hodges noted was unavoidable accident is to be used only to submit the theory that physical, non-human circumstances and not the negligence of human beings were the cause of the injuries. Sole proximate cause is to be used to determine the conduct of some person other than the defendant in the suit was the sole proximate cause of the injuries. And as this court, as Justice Mazzi said in the majority opinion in Winn-Dixie, and in fact as Professor Hodges noted, there has to be evidence of some specific physical condition or situation that was the cause of the event claimed by the plaintiff to have caused his injuries. That evidence must be presented in order to submit the unavoidable accident issue or instruction to the jury. In fact, that is precisely what we have in this case.
Mr. Hoffman, are you arguing that although an unavoidable accident instruction actually is the truth, that an accident could occur without the negligence of anyone, you accept the position that the unavoidable accident is only an issue in a case when there is some dispute over the causative nature of the accident?
Only when there is some evidence that something other than the negligence of any party caused the accident. Some extrinsic condition, if you will. Yes.
So that the purpose for submitting the instruction then is to give weight to a lawyer's argument before the jury that, hey, wait a minute, this could have occurred without my party being negligent.
No, I don't think it gives weight to the lawyer's argument at all. I think what it does is it tells the jury that an accident can occur, that sometimes accidents occur through the negligence of no one. It's not the lawyer saying, my client wasn't at fault for this accident, that the unavoidable accident instruction deals with. What it deals with is the circumstance that no one was at fault, and it doesn't tend to nudge the jury. Remember, in this case,
if this court determines that there's no evidence that this accident was the result of no negligence on anybody's part, is the converse of what you're saying, or the inverse of what you're saying, that it is improper to submit an unavoidable accident instruction?
There is not a no evidence issue before the court. And I'm a bit confused by the question. What you're asking is if the court determines that there was no evidence that this accident was caused by something other than the negligence of the parties, then as I understand the law, it would have been improper. But in fact, in this case, there is evidence that the accident was caused by something other than the negligence of the parties. The premier example that was cited by Justice Mazzi in Winn-Dixie and that has been cited for over 50 years in the jurisprudence of this state is an obstruction of view. And Mr. Young, in this case, testified that there was just such an obstruction to his view.
Why isn't that just part of the similar circumstances? If we tell jurors that negligence means a failure to act as a person of ordinary prudence under the same or similar circumstances, why isn't an obstruction or any other context in which the actors act part of the same or similar circumstances?
By that same logic, then, we wouldn't have to submit sudden emergency either, because that also is what sudden emergency is directed to.
I think there's a good argument for that, too.
Well,
in there, because why should we instruct the jury specially that something that happens, which is also part of the context under which the jury has to view the actor's performance, why should we comment on that?
A perfect example of why we ought to comment on that is contained in the application for writ in this case, because the petitioner takes the position that the mere happening of a rear-end collision is some evidence of negligence on the party striking. And there are a lot of jurors out there who presume that because there is a rear-end collision, it must have been the fault of the person who struck. They cite in their petition commentators who take that position. I would submit to the court that this court decided that that was not the law in this state more than 50 years ago. But because it's out there, I think when you have a situation in which there is direct evidence, affirmative evidence, that the accident was caused by an obstruction of view or some other circumstance beyond the control of the parties, that neither party was negligent, that no one, in fact, was negligent, that you need to be able to tell the jury that, in fact, no one was negligent.
Doesn't that, in a case where the plaintiff, maybe not this case, but say in a case where the plaintiff sues the defendant for negligence and there's no counter suit, doesn't that just naturally inure to the defendant's benefit to make that statement?
It is a defensive theory. It submits, it is an inferential rebuttal issue. All inferential rebuttal instructions are going to inure to the benefit of the defendant on that issue. The question isn't whether it inures to the benefit of the defendant. The question before the court is it calculated to cause, and did it probably cause, the rendition of an improper judgment?
Under your theory, could giving this instruction ever be harmful error?
Yes, it can.
It's always a correct statement of law, isn't it?
It is always a correct statement of law.
So when could it be harmful error to give a correct statement of law? If this inures to the defendant's benefit, but I guess you would say it doesn't nudge.
I'll give you an example. One of the points raised by the dissent in this case is that no case in Texas jurisprudence has ever suggested that a roadway could be an obstruction of view, and in fact that's something that the petitioner has raised also. This is a case in which if such an instruction had been given, I believe it would have been reversible error. It's Kirk versus Bennett, 456 Southwest 2nd, 191. It's a Texas Civil Appeals Waco case, 1976, writ refused NRE. In that case, there was an intersection just over the crest of a hill. The defendant argued that the trial judge should have submitted an unavoidable accident instruction, or actually at that time it was an issue, I believe, to the jury, claiming that this crest was something that might have obstructed the view. The Court of Appeals recognized and conceded that an obstruction of view, such as where you have that case, in fact, the jury found an unavoidable accident, and it was left undisturbed by the Court of Appeals and by this court in just such a situation where you have an intersection over the crest of a hill, and the argument was I couldn't see the plaintiff's vehicle stop because the crest of the hill was in the way. The case that I was referring to where it would have been an error is Sherwin-Williams Paint Company versus Card, 449 Southwest 2nd, 317, a San Antonio Court of Appeals case, 1970, no writ. In that case, the paint company driver claimed, well, you should have submitted unavoidable accident because this accident happened on the downslope of a hill. And the court conceded that where you have a hill that is an obstruction of view, where you lose sight of the vehicle, just as we have in this case, you would have an unavoidable accident situation. But in Sherwin-Williams versus Card, the driver testified, I never lost sight of her. I always had her in view. It never obstructed my view. And the court said it was not improper to refuse the submission. I would suggest in that situation, it would have, in fact, been improper to give the submission because there is no suggestion that something other than the negligence of the parties caused the accident. That's where it's improper. In this case, we have just the converse. We have a situation where Mr. Young testified, I did lose sight of her. I had no reason to know that these vehicles were stopping on the downslope of this overpass until I crested the overpass, and then it was too late for me to do anything. That submits not just I'm not negligent, but that this accident was caused by some extrinsic factor. That extrinsic factor is this obstruction of view, this overpass, from which I could not tell. We're not suggesting that Ms. Treamy is negligent. She had to come to a stop. The vehicles ahead of her were stopping. There isn't any real discussion about why those vehicles were coming to a stop. We can't say they were negligent. There isn't any evidence if the accident happened where Mr. Young said it happened and which the jury believed about where it happened, there is no evidence that he was, in fact, negligent. If the accident happened where he said it was caused by one thing and one thing only, and that was the existence of the overpass, which prevented him from seeing that these vehicles were coming to a stop.
In the Sherwin-Williams case, where the driver never lost sight of the other car, if there had been an instruction on unavoidable accident under those circumstances, you'll concede it still would have been a correct statement of law that an accident can happen in the absence of any negligence.
It would have been a correct statement of law.
And so why would it have been error in that case to submit an unavoidable accident instruction?
Because it does not raise the issue that the accident may have been caused by some factor other than the negligence of the parties to it.
In order to be entitled to unavoidable accident instruction has to negate the possibility that any other cause other than the negligence of the parties caused the accident?
No. I don't think he has to negate it. I think he has to present evidence that tends to show that the accident may have been caused by some extrinsic condition other than the negligence of any of the parties to it.
So you say it's not supported by the evidence? Is that
in
your answer, Sherwin-Williams versus Carr, would be that instruction was not raised by the evidence?
Absolutely, and that's what the San Antonio Court of Appeals said most distinctly. They distinctly said, yes, where you have an obstruction of view, that unavoidable accident is raised. But in this case, the evidence does not raise obstruction of view because his view wasn't obstructed by his own admission. And there was no evidence to suggest that it was, just the contrary. His testimony was he had her in sight the whole time. In our case, we have just the converse. In fact, unavoidable accident has been with us for more than 50 years. It's worked well. There haven't been a great number of decisions on this issue. But the decisions that have been found have been dealt with fairly succinctly and directly. There aren't a wide pattern of cases. The court has fairly narrowed the cases that unavoidable accident is appropriate in. I have to go back to Professor Hodges and his statement about why unavoidable accident is submitted. It is submitted not because I'm not negligent and not because you're not negligent. And quite frankly, Justice Gamage, that is why it is not confusing, nor is it redundant. The jury can always find that the plaintiff has failed to prove that I am negligent. The jury can always find that I have failed to prove that the plaintiff is negligent. It is not redundant because it submits an entirely different concept, and that is that the accident was caused by something completely other than the negligence.
There's a failure to prove negligence. Why do you need a finding that it was unavoidable? Isn't that tantamount to the same thing? It's not negligent. That's not what caused the accident. Or if they were negligent, their negligence was not the producing cause of the injury. Isn't that the same thing? Why do you need another instruction that says, and in addition to that, it was unavoidable?
Well, of course, we don't get a finding of unavoidable. And we don't get a finding that it was not due to the negligence of any party. What we get is a finding that the plaintiff has failed to prove that the defendant was negligent, and in a converse case, that the defendant has failed to prove that the plaintiff was contributorily negligent. What we don't get is a finding that, in fact, the accident was caused by the negligence of no one, that the accident was caused by some extraneous, unavoidable event.
Why do you need it?
Because you need to submit that issue, just as we need to tell the jury in an appropriate case that, in fact, accidents, even rear-end collisions, are not necessarily the fault of the striking vehicle. That the fact that we have lawyers and commentators suggesting the opposite suggests to me, and I think experience bears out, that most people tend to think that way, particularly where you have a rear-end collision.
Mr. Hoffman, I'm sorry to interrupt you. Let's suppose that the claim of the plaintiffs here was that your driver was driving too fast, having lost sight of the vehicle in front because of the overpass. So let's assume that the whole issue is that your driver lost sight of the vehicle in front and was therefore driving too fast. Is it your view that under those circumstances, unavoidable accident would have been improper here because obstruction of view was in fact the issue that was submitted? His view was obstructed, he knew his view was obstructed, and therefore he was negligent in the operation of his vehicle under those circumstances, and your view would be that in that setup of the case, then the unavoidable accident would have been improper to submit?
Probably. And actually, there are several cases that deal with that issue, particularly with icy or slick streets. It's not enough to say that the street was slick and therefore I get an unavoidable accident submission, because I think this court has recognized that in some circumstances you need to be aware of that and adjust what you're doing accordingly.
So if my claim was you just were negligent in the operation of your vehicle, period, would there ever be a circumstance where unavoidable accident would be proper if there's a collision between your vehicle and some other vehicle? If I just say you were negligent in the operation and we'll go to trial and decide what the facts were, could you ever submit an unavoidable accident there if there's a collision with your car?
Absolutely. Why not? Where the evidence shows that, or there is evidence that in fact I have no reason to suspect, as we have in this case, I have no reason to suspect that these vehicles are coming to a stop. I'm not riding too fast. In fact, the officer testified there was no evidence of undue speed. Ms. Creamy testified he wasn't traveling too close behind me. The fact that she was stopped there for 4 or 5 seconds suggests that there was no undue speed and she was only a quarter of a mile behind, and that he wasn't traveling too close.
In other words, your argument is your client's not negligent.
I'm arguing
that's why you're entitled to unavoidable accidents, because your client wasn't negligent.
I'm arguing that I'm entitled to an unavoidable accident instruction because the evidence suggested that there was some extraneous circumstance which caused this accident, as opposed to any negligence on my client's part or any negligence on any other party's part. In that sense, the answer is yes, but it is not entirely yes, because it's not just my client's lack of negligence that entitles me to that issue. It is also the fact that there is an extraneous circumstance which explains this accident that has nothing to do with my client's negligence, where my client nor anybody else is negligent. And that, in fact, is the difference between unavoidable accident and sudden emergency, because sudden emergency focuses the jury's attention on...
Isn't that, in fact, though, a circumstance that would mitigate against negligence?
Does it mitigate against negligence? Of course it mitigates against negligence. That's the purpose for the submission of the issue. Because it...
And why do you need an additional submission of an unavoidable accident if that is a mitigation against negligence under those circumstances?
To tell the jury that, in fact, sometimes accidents just happen without the negligence of any party to them, that they can happen, that just because there's a collision doesn't mean that somebody had to be at fault. We would ask that the court affirm the trial court and the Honorable Court of Appeals.
Any other questions?
Thank you, counsel. That concludes the third argument. That concludes the third argument in this call. No, I was advised he had no time remaining. That concludes the third argument. The court will take a brief recess.